Hello, hello, and welcome back. It's episode 13 of Cambro Conversations, and today we are talking about resilience and the commando mindset. In order to do that, we are joined by Ben Williams, who tells us his pretty incredible story of being on the brink of taking his own life, to joining the Royal Marines and serving our country in Afghanistan, to returning and battling with PTSD, to come out the other side of that and found his own resilience and mindset coaching business in order to support and work with businesses, sports teams, and individuals who want to gain the insight from Ben's experiences and implement a stronger mindset in their everyday life as well. I'm really excited to be sharing this because ultimately I think we can learn a lot from people who've served in the military. And Ben's story is incredible in that he's come through two kind of periods of adversity or two sets of trees, as you'll hear in the episode. So without any further ado, let's get into it. Hi folks, welcome back to another episode of Cambro Conversations, and today we are talking about resilience. And who better to speak about resilience with than a former Royal Marine Commando and mindset and resilience coach, Ben Williams. Ben, welcome to the podcast.
How's it going?
I'm really excited for today because I came across your story scrolling through LinkedIn any other day, and it popped up in my timeline of one of my connections had liked it. And you'd featured in an article in the Times, and it was all about your experience as a Royal Marine, but also your experience before that as well, which was a bit of a challenging period for you. You had such an amazing career in the military, and then you've now gone on to start your own business in resilience and mindset and supporting coaching. So I think there's a lot for us to cover today. I'm excited for my listeners to benefit from that, Ben. Do you want to give a bit of a short background on yourself then to get us started?
So where to start? I had to shave my head a few years ago because I think my lifestyle choices took a bit of a turn on my hairline. So I always start with that sort of identification that I've had to shave my hair because my hairline's gone really mad because of the things I put myself through. But everyone's got their own type of upbringing, haven't they? Everyone's got their own stories, and I never sort of really focus on mine in a sense of is why I am what I am today or certain reasons as to why things happened. My parents had quite an unfortunate break, which wasn't the nicest break, a divorce, and we ended up moving around. My brother and I was six homes, and moved around quite frequently, and then we finally settled. And I always found that I never really fitted in that well because I don't think I had time to establish my feet and fitting in well. I just couldn't fit in that well. And then when I finally started to fit in well, my choices in the music I liked and the way I was sort of carrying myself didn't really fit in with the cool kids. You know, I'm a big, big heavy metal listening fan. And so listening to heavy metal when you're at school sort of in the early 2000s was a little bit frowned upon for some reason. It didn't help that I'd sometimes come to school with black nail varnish on and things like that.
So you were a goth, Ben.
Do you know what? People ask me that. They say, oh, you're a goth, were you? I was like, I wasn't a goth. I was like, we in where I'm from, in Bedford, we used to call them Grebos. That's what they were
really?
Called.
Never Grebos heard that.
Grebos were like the middle ground between skater and goth. And in the middle was a Grebo. So I suppose it sounds like a real horrible degraded name now, doesn't it? But I was a Grebo, yeah. But I was a big, you know, big Slipknot fan, Korn fan. And I think that it doesn't attract, like, maybe who you want to hang around with at school. And it's suddenly the reason why I talk to him. He's a weirdo, listens to metal in the corner, which I still listen to. So didn't harm me. And then that got to the sort of point where I felt like I had to prove myself to fit in. Certain life experiences up to that point had sort of filled me with a bit of hate and a bit of, and it wasn't the music, it was certain things that happened that did make me quite angry.
Okay.
And I began smoking weed when I was about 12. So I started smoking weed before I was smoking cigarettes. And that was kind of like where it all really began. You know, 12 years old, smoking weed is not a really clever thing to do. But what it did was introduce me to the what I thought was the cooler people.
Okay.
And obviously I can hang around with a few extra people who smoke weed with, and it seemed like the thing to do. But I still wanted to there was something in the back of my head that wanted to be an alpha male. I don't know why, but I wanted to be some form of alpha male, and I could never get it. So I felt like I had to prove it. When I was a young kid, my dad used to take me to the Royal Marines Museum. So when they had their break, we would go to the Royal Marines Museum maybe every now and then on a weekend with dad, or would go to the parachute regiment. I remember being 8-9 years old, just being almost besotted by these things, a picture of these veterans, the places they would go around the world and all these things. And I think that's where it began for me, but I lost it along the way. You know, that was a real passion of mine. I was like, wow, I want to be an elite infantry soldier. But I lost that vision along the way. And I think that kind of partly was due to why I was quite angry, is because I couldn't do what I wanted to do. And so I slipped right off into the wrong direction. And, you know, that for me was a real bad move, to be honest. And I ended up getting involved in, you know, worse drugs and fighting. And then I was in sixth form, and I had this good idea that I wanted to really try and prove myself. You know, I was still quite, not weedy, but I was a small kid.
Okay.
18 years old, I was at school in sixth form and then also working nights as a bouncer and crap bouncer as well. trying to prove myself. So I was a bit tired, but it was my way of trying to prove myself. And then, you know, you stay doing something long enough, you get better at it. And then I finished school and I was like, well, I'm just going to keep doing this. I didn't pick a career and I just went full time. So I was working Thursday, Friday, Saturday, break on a Sunday, work Monday, then Wednesday. So I was working 5 days a week at nights in the clubs. And I was enjoying it, you know. Suddenly I was getting a bit bigger and I was getting a bit stronger. And I was scrapping a lot. And I thought I'd found my feet as a person.
That outlet for your anger, potentially?
Did it work for my anger?
Was it an outlet for your anger that was kind of inside?
Yeah, it was an outlet, but it was the wrong outlet, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Channeling it all wrong. And there was still like this quite bitterness inside where I knew I wasn't doing what I wanted to do, but it was near enough. And I got involved in some real unfortunate incidences, one of which, unfortunately, someone lost their life. Okay. And we were, for about a year, I was on a manslaughter charge, which went down from murder. All of us were on a murder to manslaughter charge. And then it got dropped because it was deemed as an accidental death, which it was, but it took, you know, all I kind of knew with it. And that's not the worst part, is it? The worst part, someone lost their life and some children lost their dad. And it introduced me to the real dark side of the world, where I'd gone too far in, you know, far too far in. When things like that happen, you know what like the real dark side of life looks like. And that really threw me, you know, really, really threw me off. And you lose your job. And then I hadn't gone for anything. So I was taking more drugs, selling my car and all this type of stuff. So things went pretty bad, really bad. And then, I was on a really strange week where I sort of come to the decision that I didn't really want to be here anymore. So I just drove and just got my brother's car and was just driving around like, thinking I'm going to do myself. I was angry and I was shouting at myself. And then it was like a few hours went by and I'd completely bottled it. And I was at home on YouTube. It's all a complete blur, but I remember being on YouTube and the old Royal Marines advert from 2001. So we're sort of speaking around 2007 at the moment, 2008. The old Royal Marines advert from 2001 came up just randomly on the screen and I watched it. And that was it. I was like, what the fuck am I doing? Now, the way I was thinking was just completely wrong. And it took me to watch this video. Like I just kept watching it and watching it and watching it and watching it. And then it was a young lad who kept getting stuck in a tunnel. And he's like, it says, if you got stuck here, I can't remember the exact words, but would you give up here? No. Would you give up here? Would you give up here? And it got all the way to the end. So would you give up here? If yes, don't even fill out the form. And then like the end part of the video is, they're on a speedboat at night and he's wearing his green beret and he looks awesome. It's like, fuck. And it just, it put me back to the Portsmouth Museum when I was eight, and just remember standing in that kid's, you know, that inspired clean kid's feet with his mouth open, looking at stuff. And I was back there and I was like, why am I doing this? What the fuck? And then just literally on that moment made the decision. Unfortunately, one of the lads I used to kick around with doing some of the wrong things in life, he'd joined up. So he joined up about 3 months before I saw this video.
Before you had, okay.
Yeah, and for him to be there and then to me to see that video, and then I rang him, I was like, what's it like? He was like, do it. You know, one of my bestest mates, best bit of advice, he's like, fucking do it. And I think he kind of wanted to hear it as well. And that was it. Like, that turning moment.
Point. Turning point.
Yeah. I still had some Coke in my house as well, and I flushed it.
Okay.
And I came off Coke straight away, chucked all my, because I was using steroids at the time as well, so I chucked all my steroids away, and then I smoked weed for a little bit longer because I needed something just to drop off.
Okay.
And then, yeah, that was, I think it was like a week or two, and I was clean. And I'd never felt so healthy as well. I'd never felt so fucked, but I'd never felt so healthy, and I was clean, and I felt like I was doing something for me. And then, yeah, you go through all the rigmarole, the application, and then off to the careers office several times, and then you do the fitness test, and it's still looking at about a year to get in, maybe 7 months to get in. But all of a sudden, a year later from being clean, I was at the gates of Commando Training Center turning up as a Royal Marines recruit. And that for me was, I even had it in my head now at that point. I was like, well, if I don't make this course, I survived what I thought would see me off, and I've got here. I've got further than most people thought I'd get. So let's do this extra bit more, which yeah. Turns out to be 32 weeks of the hardest infantry training in the world, which is hard for a reason. But that
that's incredible, Ben. I mean, I was wrapped in your story there, and I was wrapped in it when I read it in the Times as well. And I think if there's one thing the listeners can take from that immediately, it's that you were on the edge. You were at your lowest. You'd been involved in some stuff that didn't make you feel like a good individual and was pushing you towards maybe not wanting to be part of the world anymore, which is
yeah.
as bad a place as you can get. But something hit you hard inside, which was that kind of taking you back to your innocence as a child when you did have that passion for something clean and something untouched by the kind of the dirt and the scars that you built up over the last however many years when you'd been involved in some kind of unsavory things. And I think that's fantastic that YouTube, the algorithm, whatever was going on, managed to bring that video up for you and pull you back from the edge of the cliff.
Yeah, and it's exactly that. And we can speak about this shortly, but I talk about this thing a lot now, that if you can unearth your... I actually sort of stumbled across it through Simon Sinek when he was talking about Find Your Why. And I read Find Your Why and I liked it. But a part of me was like, it's not enough. It wasn't enough for me. For me, for some it is. I remember someone posing a question to me who first sort of introduced me to it. They were like, oh, you should read this book. And I was like, oh, okay, I read it. And they were like, what do you think? And gave my feedback. And they were like, so, you know, what's your why? And I was like, well, my kids. Yeah, but why? Well, because I love them. Yeah, but why? And I was like talking to my kids. I was like, what do you mean? Why? What's with all the why questions? You can't go around. And so for me, it wasn't cemented enough for what was said. So, and it through experience, like remembering being in that little kid's shoes in Portsmouth, what he saw was something he wanted to achieve. For me, that's an inspiration. That's what we all have inside of us. Every single person has something they are dying to achieve. Many of us have more than one thing, but a lot of us have something that we're dying to achieve, but we put it off for certain reasons that we don't want to put it off, but we put it off, you know, family, friends, the unknown, uncertainty, what if I fail, you know, the what ifs, the questions, the possibility of it going wrong. That puts us off, so we never do it, but then we sit with regret and anger, and I think that's where I was with it, where I was angry that I wasn't doing what I should be doing, which is following my footsteps. I thought were laid out for me, and it took me years and an immense amount of fuck ups to suddenly sit there. Like, it almost took my life to suddenly realise, mate, what the fuck are you playing at? Just, you got one life, live it. Ironically, one life, live it. Go and live it in the Marines at the height of the war. Like, okay, crazy ways of doing things. But it was fulfilment. Now, that's really what it was. And to just be at the gates, I remember getting to the gates, as much as I was worried and scared, like, what's to come. I remember just looking at, like, see the lads walk by wearing their green berets, or recruits further on in training, and, you know, the awe-inspiring intensity of the environment. It was just, it was empowering for your own ability. That's how I found it. So I'm in the right place.
It just kind of it stimulated something inside you that needed to be kind of woken up in order to progress and become more fulfilled, as you've said.
Yeah. I think a lot of us know it. A lot of us know what we want. I think what happens is many of us lack the courage to do what we want, and it takes something. I don't class myself as courageous. I just found where I wanted to be. And ironically, as life moves on, you find new things as you move along. You know, what I'm doing now is awesome. I absolutely adore what I do now. But I adored being in the Marines at the same time. And then when that career came to an end, it was time to find something else and use the courage to go and do something else. So I think we all know what we really want to do. All of us know it. Some people need a little bit more help massaging it out, but most of us sit there and go, yeah, I do know what I want. I just, not doing it because of this, or what if this happens, which is a shame, which is a real shame. But
of course, thankfully at this stage you had begun to find that then. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about your initial stages in the Marines and what that looked like, and then obviously some of the tours that you went on?
Yeah, so training was training. I had quite a rough time in training. Within 2 weeks, a friend of mine was killed outside of training in a car crash. And like, the first few weeks of training is really like just full on crazy. You're quite disorientated. Your head's shaved. You all look the same. It's quite a bewildering place to be. You're living in a room that's built for 60 people. So there's no like privacy, or it's quite an intimate environment. And a friend of mine was killed in a car crash. I remember thinking, fucking hell, like, I've been here 2 weeks and this is like, already like big, big challenges. And in fair play, like, you're not allowed to go home for like the first 5 weeks. And in all fairness, my troop boss, who's in charge of us at the time, who's an inspiring person himself, is like, go home for 2 days, goes to his funeral and come back.
Yeah.
So that was difficult. And then within, by week five, I had an infection, like a horrible staph infection, which was oozing, which I caught up on the mud run, the infamous mud run. On the mud flats, and I couldn't shift the infection. So, and then I missed a crucial exercise. So then I had to get back troop, which means you go back a few weeks, which is demoralizing. So 5 weeks in, I'm like, oh, this is just not meant to be whatsoever.
Yeah.
But then I found my feet. I stayed infection free and plodded on. And then I got to the last 3 weeks of training and I fell down part of a cliff and did my back in. So then I had to go through rehab for 3 or 4 months. I only got back into training and then passed out. So, but that's not uncommon. Like, 75% of guys will get injured or meet some hurdles along the way, which will sort of prevent or extend the length of their training.
I guess it's designed to test you to your limits and almost break you to an extent, but then you go back and you go through that again.
Yeah, strip you down to build you back up.
Okay.
Pretty much the used terminology. They do sort of come away from break you down now, because breaks quite, the world we live in now, break sounds quite different, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Break you. But it is that. It is that. It's make you just the most basic human being again, and then build you from up from there where you want to be. And I think, you know, it's, I was pissed off at the time, but I'm glad I kind of got injured. I'm glad, you know, that my losing a friend's not nice, and that wasn't nice. That's not glad of that one. But everything else that happened in training, which sort of stopped the flow of it, I look at now and go, I'm glad that happened, because it teaches you how to be resilient. It teaches you that you know where to dig deep. And, you know, when you're in a troop of lads, which you've been with for 20, 30 weeks, they're your brothers. You know, you eat, sleep, piss and drink together. You know, that they're the people you spend the most time with. And so when you get have to leave that troop and then they crack on, and you're with a new troop where you don't know anyone, it feels quite, it's not the nicest feeling, but then quickly adapt. And that's part of it, you know, and we can talk about it shortly, but that's where sort of ARA comes into, which I can allude to later on. But it, you've got to adapt to situations, and that makes you resilient. And so, yeah, I found training to be quite difficult, but it, the more difficult it is, the better. I think that you come out the end, and then your green berets, like, I have this on my desk because it is who I am.
Yeah.
It makes it even more worth earning. The prize is bigger.
I love that, because nothing worth earning is easily given. And I know that's a lot of the times these kind of platitudes sound a bit hollow, but it's certainly the case when it comes to your military training, and that, that's a massive test. I've got a friend that's in the Navy, and I imagine he would say how hard his basic training is, and you would say how hard the Marines is, which is kind of famously so. And he certainly says that the experience of going through that hardened him and made him a much better person, not just a military operative, which I think some people will maybe think of as challenging, but a lot of other people will agree with.
I think that's absolutely, you know, that's spot on. Because what I do now in life is I use elements of my commando mindset to help people find their own edge. That's what I do, along with the lads in my business and lasses in my business. So we all have this commando mindset. We all have this military mindset. We all have this ability to think how we think. We're all human beings. I get some people aren't cut out of the same formula, the same DNA to go running around in fields. And some people just don't want to do that. But that doesn't mean the mindset's not there. And so for me, joining Marines, coming from, you know, drugs, and I love my friends. I still speak to them and see them, who I used to kick around with and get in trouble with. They're good friends. But I know where I stand with it now. I know what I need to do. But going to join Royal Marines, I was suddenly surrounded by just this oozing excellence. You know, people who I felt were better than me. And I love the saying, I don't know who I heard it from, where I heard it. I just heard it off the cuff, I think. If you're the best person in the room, you're in the wrong room.
Agree.
And I think that's so true. For me, that's what I felt like going to the Marines, was that I was suddenly surrounded by people who showed me who I could be. You know, my intrinsic motivation was there, but there was more of an extrinsic motivation as well to show me that I can do more. And sometimes that wasn't even through voice. That was seeing guys do things that you just thought was not possible, makes you think, I can give that a go as well. Something you would never try in your life.
I'm a huge fan of that, Ben. And having people around you that make you strive for more and try to get on their level is a very healthy thing. Whereas if you surround yourself, and like you say, if you're the smartest guy in the room or the best at absolutely everything in your circle, there's not the same drive and there's not the same benchmark for you to try and strive for. And it's definitely healthy to have people around you that you want to get towards. And I know there's a kind of well-known Jim Rohn idea that the five people that you surround yourself with are who you will become effectively. Mm-hmm. And there's a kind of a further subsection to that where a percentage of those people should be people that are further beyond you. A percentage should be people on your same level. So you have competition to kind of push each other on. And then there should be somebody kind of below you that you're kind of trying to bring on with you. And I think that sounds like what you managed to achieve within the Marines, where you had those people around you that you strive to be like.
Yeah, I always say this is why I preach it. I think in my book, I wrote almost a chapter around it, was surround yourself with excellence. That doesn't mean surround yourself with perfection or people who are ultimately way better than you. Excellence in my eyes means people who strive to do the best they can. You know, they're always, you know, average isn't good enough. You know, there's just got to be that extra step more. And my corporal in training, all my corporals in training who took me through were unbelievable people. I remember one of them specifically saying, lads, if you can be 0.1% better than you were yesterday, then you're always excelling. And that might mean you're just gently going along in what may seem like a plateau, but that plateau is actually going up. And I think it's something I say to people all the time. You know, the athletes we work with, people in business we work with, is don't. Tony Robbins talks about it, marginal gains, it's always been there and will forever be there. for me, in that 0.1% is if I'm having a really shit day and I go for a run and say I'll do 5 miles today, well, just do 5 miles and 100 yards, you know, at least done a little bit more. And then I can go to bed going, I did more than I said I was going. It might have been the shittest day in the world, but that one thing you set yourself a task for, you did that 0.1% more on it.
My audience will relate to that, Ben, from a fitness perspective. And like you say, you've given a fitness example there where you run that little bit further in the gym. It's that you get that extra rep on the set of leg press or squats that you're doing. It's you add that extra 1.25 kg plate to either side and get that extra little bit. It might be that you increase your step count, you increase your running distance, you get that extra 30 minutes sleep because you get off your phone earlier. It's all these tiny little things that add up from a fitness perspective, from a business perspective. In my space, it might be I make that extra call that I didn't want to make to the finance director that's been mugging me off and not wanting to speak to me. But because I did it, I've made a marginal gain. I've made another impact. Maybe I've left him another voicemail, or maybe I get through to him this time and he remembers who I am now. There's, like you say, there's so many marginal gains that we can make each day. And I guess that your military background kind of started to build that into you from a position where you wouldn't have thought like that in the lifestyle that you were leading before.
No, yeah, well, strangely, do you think like that, but in the wrong way? You know, maybe we can get an extra line and let's have another drink. You know, can we stay up an extra hour? It's only an extra tenner. You know, strangely, it's the same. We all live this extra 0.1%. Just some people live it in the wrong direction. And that for me is the change in wind. It's like, well, we're all good at pushing ourselves. Sometimes we're good at pushing ourselves in the wrong way. So let's work towards something a bit more, you know, something more invested rather than just stupid stuff. So, yeah, and it was really a big turning point for me because I was like, 0.1% is fuck all. Like, it is nothing. And like you say, in the fitness world, that could... And I know there's people very sort of strict on how they do. Well, it's 12 reps, 12 reps, you know? It's 12 reps, not doing 13. Why not? You know, why not do 13? Or like you said, why not just stick that extra 0.5 on each side or something that just in your head you think, I've done that extra bit more than someone else. And if you're in some form of game where you not need to be competitive, but you always want to keep walking up, keep stepping up, then not everyone's going to do the 0.1% rule. Whereas if you are, you're constantly excelling. You know, if you set it as 1% a day, you're 365% better by the end of the year. So, yeah, it's just simple ways of looking at things, isn't it? It's perspective. Can make incredible changes within your life. Definitely.
Yeah, fantastic message, Ben. And I guess you touched on it earlier. The time when you were joining the Marines and going through your training was at a time when Britain was at war. And that meant that you went on a number of tours. Do you want to share a little bit about that experience?
Yeah, I was very lucky actually in the sense of Afghan. I only got one Afghan tour in because the war dropped off as we were finishing. I was lucky to travel around in other places in the world which weren't so nasty. I passed out of training and then within a year, on the day of passing out a year later, I was in Afghan. Very sort of bewildered Marine fucking hell, what am I doing here type of thing.
Okay.
But an incredible experience, you know, real, it was fucking tough. And we had a real bloody tour. We had a nasty tour. And I say this every time I talk about it, my tour wasn't worse than anyone else's tour. We lost people, we had people injured, and you do the sort of difficult things in life that you need to do within the military. Just, it was a bloody tour. It was 2011 and the IED threat was through the roof. And I think that was like the hardest challenge. It's like the enemy weren't, this is really strange, like the enemy you wouldn't really fear because you knew you could outgun them. You knew you could, like all the times we used to fight them, we would smash them. There was always that worry they knew the land more, but you would smash them.
You're organized, you've got your weapons, your equipment, and you're well trained, whereas they are pretty much just rebelling against what's going on, aren't they? And so is it almost guerrilla warfare? Am I using that term correctly?
It was very guerrilla. And in fact, it was difficult at times. I think it was we had the Chechens turn up at our doorstep one time to fight us. Because they just like being there and scrapping. But Yeah, we did. You could tell you came up when you came up against organised enemy outfits, and then you can tell when you came up against the sort of rebellious farmers. Equally, bullets are bullets. So if it's aiming for you, it's going to hurt or not. You don't treat them. There's no ego. You don't treat them like they're nobodies. You treat them like they're a fully well-armed force. But there was that element of confidence that you kind of, you train, there's 14 Marines per troop going out on the ground, heavily armed. You can pull in air when you need to pull in air. You can pull in mortars and gun batteries. So you have the technology upper hand. You have the trained upper hand. I remember the interpreter, because they used to be able to listen to the Taliban on the radios. They could intercept their frequencies. And they said, yeah, we'll be careful for the next few weeks. The Marines are here. I thought that was like, you know, that did breed a bit of an ego. And they soon put you in check as well. But I remember thinking, they worry about us. They're scared of the Marines. That's fucking cool. We've got a reputation with the Taliban. But although they were a fearsome force, and you would pay them as much respect as you pay anyone else respect, it was the IEDs they used to lay, which was the hardest thing to deal with, because they didn't need feeding, they didn't need watering, they didn't need to breathe. They just switched them on and left them in the ground. They run off big batteries, which have the voltage to sustain themselves for fuck knows how long. And they were so simple, and they were barbaric. And, you know, and you'd be walking along on a nice, quiet, summery sort of day, and then the world erupts around you, and it's quite, you have a huge respect for the ground and what it means to walk one step in front of the other, and what it's like to step from the gates and the threat. And, you know, you could deal with the enemy, you couldn't really deal with the IEDs, and they were everywhere. They were literally littered the place. So that was difficult. That was very difficult to deal with, but again, you have to learn to deal with it, don't you? You have to learn to put one step in front of the other. If you're constantly looking at the ground, you know, get distracted by what's there, then you're going to miss the enemy in the tree line. So you have to be able to put things to back your head. I think that's really helped our thinking at the moment that, you know, coronavirus is here. It's not nice. But if you go out your door constantly worried about it, you can be worried about it all you want, but that's not going to change anything. What you can do is change your actions, you know. Cover up your hands, wear your face masks, disinfect and all that, 2 meter spacing, social distancing, pay respect, don't get complacent, and stay switched on. And that was the same way you deal with in combat with, you know, the IED threat is don't get complacent, stay switched on, do the best you can do to at least try and find them. You can't stare at the floor and worry all the time, otherwise you can't do your job. But that was hard, and we lost a lot of people to IEDs as well. It's one of our lads' anniversaries tomorrow. Okay. So yeah, that was difficult, but again, it's on the dotted line, don't you? You sign up to go and do this stuff, and it is just part of war, unfortunately.
What are the biggest lessons that you learned from your tour in Afghanistan?
I learned to shit outdoors quite well. That was one. You can get through anything. That was the biggest no one wants to be in like the most hideous, violent positions, situations like that. No one really wants to be taking life. You're there to do a job. But I think one of the biggest things for me was, what really underpinned it was the ability to understand what values really mean and what you value, and actually how values can help you make decisions you didn't think you could make, and help you think with clarity. And there was always this, like, and we mentioned it before the call, I didn't read the Chimp Paradox till about 2 or 3 years later after Afghan. But I remember reading it thinking, I can really see situations there where you're thinking in like an emotional state, and you can't think in an emotional state. You have to think with utter clarity. You know, if someone's been killed, they've been killed. If they've been injured and they're on a helicopter on the way back to Camp Bastion, well, that's where they're going. That's completely out of your control. What's within your control now is your actions and your ability to soldier correctly. You can't think in an emotional state. It's the same for, we talk to fighters, and fighters tell us more than we tell them, you know, mutual understanding that if you think with anger or you fight with anger, you'll probably lose the fight. It's the same sort of detaching your emotions in that way in the battlefield is, as hard as it is, you have to be quite strict in just putting that thought process to one side in order to operate effectively. And I think that's the unfortunate thing, is so many people bottle stuff up then. Then they come home and they've got all this stuff which they've emotionally detached to, then that's all they can think about. And then that's where we start to see quite nasty mental health reasons, but problems. But yeah, for me it was like the ability that you can overcome anything as well. Like you can literally face death and overcome anything. And it's kind of through reflection that I've really, you know, I'm not someone who goes around preaching about like military and how amazing we are and like you should listen to us, because we're all human beings. And I think I like to learn from all the industries, and I like to learn from lots of people. And I think great things that we do in the military, and I think there's some wrong things we do, but and vice versa in the civilian world. My belief is that we're all human beings, and that we can all get through situations we might not think we can get through. We can all achieve things we might not think we can achieve. And equally, what the best thing Afghan gave me was this respect for life.
Okay.
And to come home and say, why have I rested on my laurels with my goals? Why am I not ticking my bucket list off? Why am I heading towards 52 to go, oh, I'm having a fucking midlife crisis? Why?
Yeah.
You know, what's your fucking excuse? And I think it, for me, you don't want to see the things you see on the battlefield, but that was helpful in a way to say, look how easy it can be taken away. Do something for yourself. And that's what I love working with people on now is, you know, how long do you leave it? Why do you want to leave it? You know, you don't want to leave it. There's a great book. In fact, I've got it here in my reading pile. Here we are, first book. Bronnie Ware, Regrets of the Dying.
Okay. I haven't heard of it myself.
A little bit morbid, but she was a nurse in palliative care. And so she, Australian, she spent a lot of time with older people in their last few weeks of living, basically. And she started, I'll read them to you now, very quick. She started picking up when they were passing away on their regrets. So, you know, understanding what they were thinking as they were passing away. So she found 5 regrets which came out. I wish I had the courage to live a life true to myself. I wish I hadn't worked so hard. I wish I had the courage to express my feelings. I wish I'd stayed in touch with my friends. I wish I let myself be happier. Wow. I read that book a couple of years later and thought, why is it the cancer survivor who goes, I'm going to go and run a marathon, or I'm going to do something crazy? You know, people which have survived illnesses or near-death experiences are the ones who go, that was close, so I'm going to go and do something. Equally, you look at roads, signposts are only there because something's happened. And so we're very good at human beings of waiting for something to wake us up. And it was the same for me. You know, I'm not preaching that I'm the one who knows best, because it took me a war to work it out. But it helped me work out, and it gave me the respect very early on in my life, sort of 22 years old, to go, this is respect life. You know, could be gone one day, so make sure you're doing something. And that sort of really comes back into my corporal saying, do that 0.1% better each day, was also do that 0.1% better for yourself each day. You know, do something for you each day. Work towards your goals, work towards something. Because how dreadful would it be to lie on your deathbed under a tartan blanket, looking at your toes, sighing, thinking, well, I wasted that.
So that was probably one of the key things that you learned from your tour. And I think that's something that anybody, regardless of whether they've served in the military or not, can implement, to kind of that appreciation for life, and that appreciation that we don't want to leave ourselves with regrets, and that we've got the chance to chase our goals while we're here and functioning. So let's do that.
Now more than ever as well is the wake up time. I don't know how many people you spoke to over the last few weeks. I've spoke to so many people who have gone, oh, the horrible same old sentence, I wish I did this before COVID-19. Yeah. But, you know, COVID-19 is here now. It's locked us up for a while. We will get our freedom back. We've already got quite extended exercise back, and it won't be too much longer until life seems to probably come around a bit more to normality. So does COVID-19 become a wake-up call for many people? Is this that moment for people gone, I was taking the wrong thing seriously before all this. I was working too hard. I was spending less time with my family. I was doing this, I was doing that. let this wake you up, and let it keep you wake you up as well. Don't just come out of this and go right back to normality. It's like, sustain that wake up call. What is that goal you're going to chase?
I certainly hope so, Ben. Now, we've hinted at it in the podcast so far, ARA, which is three rather important letters when it comes to the mindset that you built within the military, and something that's transferable importantly to most of the people listening, whether it's fitness, business, career, whatever it is they care about, they can employ this acronym, can't they?
It's a very simple acronym, and I came up with it with my business partner actually after a glass of wine, where I think some of our ideas flow best, as does the bottle. But we're trying to work out how we function in battle, and when bad things happen, how you continue to do your job. And ARA was built from that. ARA basically stands for accept the situation, remove unwanted emotion, and then adapt to the situation. But we beat it around the bush for ages on it, trying to make it complicated, trying to turn it into some sort of elaborate strategy that, you know, people could invest in. When really you look at it and you think, actually, no, it's just such a simple formula for when things are going wrong for people that they can quickly take that breath and just think with a bit of clarity. And so within the military, we coined this thing called the Condor Moment, which is coined from the old smoking advert, where the guy's having I think it's like 70s or 80s, having a really bad day. And then, you know, at the end, he like sparks up a cigarette. He's like, have a Condor Moment. And that's his moment to think and chill. And so, but we kind of coin that into the work we do within the military, where when things are going really wrong, you know, in the face of battle, you have to make big decisions. And especially in a leadership role, you have to work out what flank you're going to do, how you're going to go with the enemy, you're going to go back, what's happening. You have to make immediate decisions to return fire and deal with the immediate threat. But then you have to make decisions that take focus and clarity. And you can't think with emotion in these situations. You have to think with full-on rational thinking. And we're taught to breathe, like take just a massive breath. And I know this is very widely known, like one huge intake of breath is going to take around 5 seconds. But that then floods the brain with oxygen-rich blood, which then helps the neurotransmitters between your limbic system of your brain and then your neocortex speak. And you can then end up thinking in the more rational parts of your brain rather than your limbic. I thought, I never knew that. We're just taught it. They're like, lads, breathe. Yeah, cheers, crack on. You know, they're never given the reason why. You just, why am I taking this massive breath? But you just know it works. And then when you go away from the military, you spend time around the books and such things as Chimp Paradox and Mindset by Carol Dweck and those types of ones, you kind of go, oh, fucking hell, this is why they're teaching us this stuff. You kind of think, did the instructor even know this, or they're just passing it on?
Yeah.
But you learn this stuff. And then when you think about ARA, is accept, is that immediate, right, it's happened. You know, how many people have you heard that say that in your life? You're like, right, hey, it's happened. But what does that really mean? You know, then there's the second part of it. Okay, it's happened. Then what do you do with it? For us in combat, you know, if someone was killed or injured, it's happened. You have to deal with the moment, deal with the injuries, deal with what you need to deal with. Then they're on the helicopter and then they go. You've still got the rest of the mission to crack on. You've still got the rest of the operation to do. You still got the rest of the tour to complete, and you can't sit around moping and thinking about it. Of course, you have moments to deal with these situations, but it's at the right time, at the right place, and the right time is not on the battlefield in front of the enemy. So you have to think with clarity. And so that immediate acceptance of a situation has to occur. It's, fuck, that's happened. Right, okay, that's happened. And then you have to ask yourself how you're feeling around that situation. This does not take a long process. This is, you know, removing unwanted emotion is not becoming emotionless. It's thinking about these unwanted emotions that can cloud the way you're thinking. If someone's been killed, if you start lying on the ground next to them, crying your eyes out, which seems like the nicest, easiest thing to do, then you're one set of eyes taken away from the enemy. You're a rifle not looking at the enemy. You're not doing your job. And even more to that, you can't think with anger. You can't think with revenge, because then you may make some sort of murderous mistake that's going to take out the wrong person. So you have to have that immediate conscious decision to go, accept, I've got to remove the way I'm thinking here. You know, I have to think with clarity. I have to think this is a job. I need to get on with it. And then you have to adapt to the situation. And adapt, we can go around the bushes of what that is, but that's very subjective to the person. So yeah, that's what it really means. And it's amazing because we've been talking about it for some time with people. We've never really thought anything of it. We've got another strategy that we pour a lot of effort into and never really thought about ARA. And then people were ringing us and emailing us and messaging saying, oh, I've just implemented that ARA thing. It's so effective. And it's simply like just taking 5 seconds to stop, assess, you know, everything that's going on and accept that moment.
I think the simplicity of it is where the beauty lies in it though, Ben, because it's easy to understand, it's got logic, and it's applicable. So you can take action on it rather than some highbrow theory that people are like, oh, that sounds brilliant. And then they forget about it or they disregard it within a week of you coming in to speak to them or coming to speak to their team or their business, whatever format you're speaking to them in, they disregard it. Whereas ARA, I only heard it recently through yourself, but straight away I can see where I can apply it in moments of high stress or challenge. And it's relevant in so many different contexts rather than purely in the military, which is why one of the big reasons I was so keen to have you on is that there's lots that can be learned from the military that can be introduced in civilian life, as you would call it. And that's why it's important that it's an actionable, short, 3-letter acronym which we can implement.
Yeah. And I think what's key to understand is adversity is not a nice thing to go through. It's for everyone. It's got its name for that reason. And when adversity strikes, it's not nice. What happens to you during whatever that situation is it isn't nice. That's adversity. How we deal with adversity is what makes us. People can lie around crying and hitting the floor. And I was one of those people, you know, I was an angry, pent up person. So when things went wrong, it was like, what can be struck? Well, that's actually an emotional response. And so I talk with a huge authenticity, but integrity as well, that my life was completely different when I wasn't thinking this way. And now it's completely different in a positive light for thinking like this way. So that's why the simplicity of ARA works. And I use it all the time. I logged on to do a webinar Monday, and some reason all my webinars have been wiped, you know, across all the football stuff. Everything had just gone off the system, and immediately I was looking at the window thinking I could fit the laptop through that gap quite easily, you know, just in an instant angry moment. But you can't, you just have to take that step back and go, well, the webinars are gone. Yeah. How can I find them? What can we do to make like this happen? And so it's not like just the grand scheme of things. And, you know, when people pass away or something horrible happens within our lives, it's the really minimal things. Like, where have I put my keys? I'm in a rush. ARA, you're not going to be able to find your keys if you're running around like a headless chicken.
Right.
But you can find them if you just go, right, where was I? You know, and take it with clarity. It's all about clarity. Adversity is shit, but it makes it who you are, and how you deal with it at the time makes you far more resilient as you move through life.
Brilliant. So such an actionable point. And you've spoken about dealing with adversity. When you returned from Afghanistan, I know that was something that you perhaps struggled to do for a period. Do you want to share with the listeners a little bit around that period and how you found your roadmap forward?
Yeah. Coming back from Afghan was like a real turning point, and it's, like, I was blown up in Afghan 3 or 4 weeks before the end of the tour. My entire section were hit. So 6 of us were injured in the blast and 3 were very badly injured. And so it was cut short right at the last moment for me. And so when I was back in the UK, being around my family and my friends, I didn't want it. No, fuck off. It was really blunt as well. I don't want to be around you. My friends are on the battlefield right now. That's where my mind is. And people were still dying. And it was harder to deal with back here than it was out there. Right. Because you felt like you could do something out there, but back here you couldn't. And so I think I came back quite almost borderline how I was thinking before I joined the Marines, you know, very bitter and angry. And, you know, the IED, which took out all of us, it went off behind me. So I still kind of live with that guilt feeling of, did I see it? Did I not see it? Could I have done more?
Yeah.
You know, not so much now, but at the time. And so, yeah, I went into a bit of a spiral. Like, drink was the easiest thing to just go to, drinking. And when you live in like that ferocious 6 months where it's the violence is the worst human violence can be, it's killing people. You get adrenaline fixes with that, which you just can't replicate anywhere else. But what you do is you try to replicate it. You know, this is why people turn to gambling, drinking, taking drugs. And it answered a lot of questions. When I got out my trees again, you know, I've been through two big sets of trees, I think, in my life. When I got out, you know, after Afghan and went through another set, it was a huge amount of reflection to answer a load of questions from way before the Marines, like why I was doing drugs and that answered my questions, which was quite nice to do. It was like, that's why I did it, mate. All right, so don't beat yourself up about it. But the worst bit about Afghan was I kind of felt myself going back to that,
okay,
slipping a little bit towards where I'd originally came from. And I took probably about a year and a half to get through it properly, and had you know, treatment and therapy and all the drugs and stuff like that. And then I was just like, oh, fuck this. It was almost the same reaction I had before I joined the Marines. It was another, fuck this. Why is it like this? And just by chance, a good friend of mine who was like heavily involved in the personal development world, a Marine himself, you know, loves Tony Robbins and all that stuff, gave me Steve Peters' book, The Chimp Paradox. And I read like the first chapter and I was like, wow, Mr. Peters has written this directly to me. And it explained so much of, it just put a lot of things into light for me.
Yeah.
And then I got three chapters in. I was like, fucking hell, what's he on about here? Like, it got a bit mental for me, but it was my first introduction to personal development where I was able to find golden nuggets. And that was crucial for me. You know, we were talking about this before we started, that either find a book that you love or find the books that really resonate and have relevance to your life. And that's where I kind of went with my sort of personal development journey. Was what do you hear, like Bill Gates reads like 10 books a week or something ridiculous like that. Elon Musk says he reads every time, you know, Buffett says he reads so many books a year.
Yeah,
I think, oh, I gotta read a book, I gotta read all these books to be like these geniuses. And then you just kind of realize that life's too fast paced and I have two children.
I've had a lot of really interesting people on the podcast and the message seems to be really similar, where you just need to find that one self-development source that gets you started and really hits home. And yeah, one of the things that I love that you said there is that you read The Chimp Paradox and chapter one blew you away. Couple of the other chapters didn't, but it's not important, because the lessons you took from the initial chapter are worth their weight in gold. It didn't matter what came in the rest of the book. And that's what so many people need to remember. And when you're naming all these huge successful entrepreneurs and businessmen who read X number, or they listen to X number of hours of motivational or inspirational content, it's about the one chapter or the one page or the 1 hour or the 45 minutes that you listen to that really has an impact. And that's what's so important here.
It can be as simple as a sentence, you know, like take Grant Cardone, for example. He's Marmite. I haven't worked out if I like him or not. I think, yeah, you know, and I won't go off on a tangent because you never know who's listening. But I like some of the things he says, not all of it. Some of it is, it's kind of regurgitated. But I remember he said one thing that was, you never fail anything. The only time you fail is when you quit. And I thought, that's brilliant. That's brilliant. I don't want to go around the houses reading all your books. I just want to know what page that's on of what book. And that's the book I get, because that's all you need. You need those little tiny little bits of golden nuggets all over the place. And I think definitely, it's starting with either the books that interest you or the author. You know, I really like Simon Sinek. I like how he writes. I like how he articulates his messages. So he drew me in. Cardone, I've got a few of his books just because I like his audio books because he's pretty mad with them.
I've listened to 10X and it was helpful from a sales perspective. It's the same message, like you say, regurgitated over and over again, but sometimes it just gives you that kick up the bum that you need to shut up and work harder.
Yeah,
which can be helpful.
And sometimes you just hear people like so motivated, you're like, wow, right, I need to get up and get on here. And you kind of need that extrinsic kick up the arse. But yeah, for me, it's golden nuggets. It's talking to people as well. It's talking to people within your field who is relevant to yourself, you know, and you share the same sort of thinking. And I mean, people, you know, who may be on our level and working, the people who are side by side with us. And you say, what are you reading at the moment? I'm reading this. Oh, I'm going to have a look at that. Oh, I'm reading this. And that way you can actually kind of find more relevance in what you're trying to discover. Some stuff I've read, I'm a bit more of a listener personally rather than reading. You just think someone mentions a book way outside your field and you're listening to it and you can waste 7 hours. You're like, oh, I didn't really get much from that. But £14 down now. But it's finding those things that are relevant to yourself and yeah, golden nuggets. I just look for golden nuggets. I think too many people look for that one answer. The answer is only within yourself. What you may need is educating on certain areas that you can just put into your own little equation. It's like a cocktail. You're making your own cocktail. So you need to find different bits of ingredients to make your one good. And that's all you're looking for. That's all you're looking for. That's how I treat it anyway.
Another great message there, Ben. And I guess if we come up more towards present day where you've set up Vanguard, which is your business and your venture, what are some of the key things that you do? And I know that you've done some interesting talks for some pretty high profile situations, and I could be interested for my listeners to hear about some of the things that you speak about and some of the things that maybe they can take forward from what you have learned.
I'll go back in time a bit, actually, because I remember being a recruit and I remember thinking, oh, if there's one thing I really wanted to go Afghan, just because that's what wanted to do as a young recruit, raw recruit. The other thing was like I really like this idea of training recruits. The instructors you would look at, and they epitomize the Royal Marine. They're just tall, well built, they are often quite chiseled, you know, they just look the part, and they had this air of confidence and it just shone excellence. That's the way I looked at it. I just thought these instructors are just the epitome of excellence. And I always thought I really want to be one of those one day. And I did my command courses. And as part of your command courses, the training within the Royal Marines now is much more coach-based. It's not what people think it is. It's far less archaic than people think it is. It's very coach-led. So that's how we kind of breed the Marines these days. And I did some of the coaching courses as part of my leadership courses, and then was given the opportunity that out of a large group of people, like, oh, do you want to be one of the guys that goes and trains recruits? And I was like, yeah, like that's what I've always wanted to do. And I felt by that point I was experienced enough as well. And, you know, that is a huge title to be a Royal Marines instructor. You're the instructor of one of the most notorious elite regiments throughout the world. And I took great pride in that, and I was a bit of an angry bastard with my recruits, but I treated them in a way that I was treated, and I did what was I would expect myself to do. And I found this real great ability to coach them. I really enjoyed doing it, and I know I passed out great recruits, and they still speak to me now today, which I find quite a blessing. That's, you know, I know I've had an impact on them somewhere. Not all of them, some of them probably hate me, but for other reasons, but the majority of them, I think, keep in touch.
It worked well because you got awarded what, most inspirational?
So you get so each training team which passes out a troop, the recruits vote for most inspirational corporal, and I was privileged to get one on the first time round. I also work with recruits in Hunter Company, which are injured. So I worked on the rehab side, and then worked with underperforming recruits as well. So recruits that have professionally failed something and need extra education. So I found this real coaching ability. And then at the time I was told my hearing wasn't good enough to stay in the Marines was when England football team visited the Royal Marines Training Centre. And I was picked to be on the six-man team, which trained them for like 48 hours, whole weekend. And that was like a real amazing experience, because there was like no one was allowed any phones, players, Marines, staff. No one was allowed phones, and it was just us. And we, you know, I spent the first night in one of the woods, just sat around a little campfire with Harry Kane for about 4 hours, just talking shit. You know, like just talking utter rubbish. I remember actually, like, I got so involved in the conversation that it was just a normal chat between normal people. And I was like, I was talking about holiday prices. I was like, are you going anywhere nice at the moment, Harry? And he was like, yeah. Oh, well, I've just got back from Dubai. I was like, oh, nice. And then I just, the bend in me came out. I was like, I've just, do you know what? Fucking holiday price gone through a roof lately, haven't it? I've just spunked $3,500 on a fucking holiday for the family to go to Lanzarote, I think it was. Like, it sounds really chappy thinking the way I said it. And he was like, yeah, they're going up, aren't they? And it like dawned on me again. I was thinking, he's probably just paid $3,500 for a meal. I'm moaning about it, moaning to him about my inclusive holiday. But it was just really interesting to like have these actual conversations with these people you probably never have it with. And talk about things that I had a passion about, like values, training, coaching, you know, all that mindset, all this type of stuff. Them sharing some stuff with us, me sharing some stuff with them, and actually forming relationships, you know, still keep in touch with a few of the lads to this day. And that was my moment where I went, yeah, maybe I actually like doing this away from the military as well. If I'm getting asked to leave the military because of medical reasons, then maybe this is what I want to do. And then just took a massive punt. And yeah, a year and a half later, I was kicked out. And during the time of being told I was getting kicked out to getting kicked out, I started burrowing away in the darkness with my business partner, and we built Vanguard. And it sort of went from there, really. Like, it's such a blur up to this point, and then who we've worked with and everything. It's just been incredible. It's been a fucking difficult ride. COVID's not made it too easy as well, but it's been a really inspiring ride as well. And again, empowering, just shows you what you can do, doesn't it? For me, the big turning point last year, I was in a boardroom at one of the big global banks, surrounded by directors who were asking us to do a service for them, but we kind of had to pitch back to them. It was quite surreal. And I thought, I sat there in a tie. I don't like wearing ties. And I sat there in a suit and tie, and business partner Tomo's next to me, and he's been in corporate. So he was a Marine, and he came outside a few years before me, and he went and worked with some of the big consultancies in London. So he got his commercial experience fast. So he's all over this in the directors' rooms, and I'm like, I felt like a fucking red thumb. I felt like just sat there, just like, yeah, you're right, mate. You know, just saying things wrong. And I called something a knobber as well, like, or knobhead. I said knobhead in this meeting. And and I remember sitting there before I said knobhead, I was thinking, I considered taking my own life. You know, this is for me. I don't care if anyone takes anything from this. Well, I do care, but it was my fulfillment. And I sat there thinking, I've got two children, a mortgage. I was addicted to like the worst things I thought could be addicted to. I wanted to kill myself. Then I joined the Royal Marines, which is one of the most respected regiments. I fought for my country. I've worked with these people. Now I've set up my own business. And now I'm on the verge of, you know, securing a massive contract for our business with leaders of a bank. And for me, it was fulfillment saying that what I tell people, what I speak to people about is genuine. It's authentic. And I mean it from the bottom of my heart to say, if you think you can do it, you can fucking do it. And that's not me being a gold medalist athlete or something that just seems a little bit outside of our reach. That is me, normal person, saying, you think you can do it, you can fucking do it. As simple as that. And then it kind of goes from there, really.
Yeah, that's as simple and as hard-hitting a message as you can give. And I think you could package that up in whatever pseudo-intellectual bullshit you like. And we've joked about the platform that you and I were connecting on Instagram about how many mindset and support coaches there are and how many of them are coming from an actual solid foundation. But you are, because like you say, you came from a position where you couldn't have ever believed that you could have such a positive influence on people with the mindset you've got, but you can now. And yeah, it's a hugely motivational story that you've got, and I mean, I've absolutely loved hearing it. I'm really glad you've shared that today, Ben.
No, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
And in terms of things that are happening then, you've got Vanguard on the go, you're working with athletes, teams.
Yeah, so what we did actually, so one of the banks we began working with, we realized this is a big message. People don't buy your business, they buy the brand, they buy you, you're the brand of your business. And I learned this through the bank, one of the banks. I only can't say them because we're working with them at the moment. They don't like their name mentioned. Yeah, but we went through 8 pitches, took 8 months to get a contract that's worth, still is, but it's £250,000 contract, which was, you know, tidy sum for a small business that's kind of only just setting out in its first year.
Yeah.
And one of the guys said, on the 8th pitch, we've been with him for 8 months. We've seen him 8 pitches. We thought he knew us implicitly. He was like, "Oh, Ben, tell me, what's the name of your business again? What is it again? What does it do?" And I was like, I came away from the meeting thinking, is he fucking stupid? Like, we just spent the last 8 months doing this and he doesn't know who we are. And then when we sort of worked it out, it was like, he's not bought a business. He's bought us.
Yeah.
And for us, that was the biggest moment where we realized where our capability in business is to be authentic, be integral, be who you are. Not everyone will buy you. You know, there'll be people which will start to listen to this podcast which are logged off, you know, because they might not like my voice, they might not like what I'm saying. There'll be people who are listening. They're the people who you should care about. You build fans, you don't build crowds, you build fans.
You're absolutely right.
And that was like, for me, a real big turning point to realize what to do with the business next. And what we actually did was we subdivided our business that we then, Vanguard's like the mothership, you know, it's the engine, but we never really talk about it. We built Find Your Edge coaching off it, which is its own little brand itself, which is now doing all the business. And yeah, we work since starting, we sports-wise, been back to see England, Manchester United, some other Premier League teams, there are quite a few across the EFL. We've worked with UFC fighters, Wasps rugby we've been with, that's just in the sort of sports side. And when we tallied up who we had on the commercial side, we've worked with 8 FTSE 100s already.
Yeah.
And if I'm really honest, and anyone who's listening who's interested in building a business or anything like that, is don't be afraid to ask. I think, you know, going back to what you asked about Afghan, is like it teaches you things that come back not with confidence, but just what's the worst that's going to happen? Just knock on the door and ask. And we took a bit of a tactic where we would, everyone loves giving away free services, but you've got to be careful how much you give away that's free. So we knew we could do our job. So all we had to do was get through the door and just say, look, can we deliver like 2 workshops? Not 1, 2. We'll do 1 now and we'll come back in 2 weeks, deliver another one, and make them so inspiring, so powerful, so like, whoa, what's that? That they want more. And that's how we sort of secured these big businesses, because we showed them who we were first before we asked for money. And in turn, the reward's been, it's business, isn't it? You expect to build rewards. So
yeah,
that's the biggest thing for us. And that's why I think it's working so well, because we love what we do.
So many lessons out of that for everyone. And to try and relate it as much as possible to my space, where it's business development with companies that we don't currently work with. Like you say, people do buy people and they buy your brand. And ultimately, I've got this global giant behind me, but I'm the one that's trying to open the door. I'm the one that needs to get them to buy into me in order to trust me to then bring in the tools that I've got behind me, similar to this big bank needed to buy into Ben Williams and Tomo to then let Vanguard deliver the service, so to speak.
Yeah. Which is so true. That's exactly it. People buy people. You know, that is... And that's where I think, you know, we were talking about social media offline. It's, you don't see that all the time. You see what they want you to see. And it's very hard for all of us out there to fight through the noise of who's authentic and who's just generic. I think if you're relentless and tenacious enough, you will rise to the top, because one by one, people will begin to follow you. One by one, people will go, actually, they're talking fucking sense. Actually, Colin's the guy who knows what he's talking about when I speak to him. And that's how it happens. And I think what I remember stepping out of the Marines and into business thinking, yeah, I'll be rich in 6 months. People love Marines. That's how we do things, isn't it? You know, look at Anne Middleton, he's flying. And then it was a real uppercut where I didn't make any money for like, fuck knows how long, too long. But then it comes and then you realize that people are buying you. They're not buying your business, they're buying you. And then all of a sudden things start to happen. That's and I think that's the new way to do business as well.
Yeah. Again, just more brilliant messages there for people to take home. We've talked about Vanguard. Last thing to touch on is, when is Commando Mindset coming and where can people do the pre-order?
The book. When is it coming? I started writing that book in 2016 and it's coming out January the 7th. January the 7th, it's coming out. It was meant to come out today, but unfortunately due to COVID and rightly so as well, you know, there's worse things happening in the world than my book not launching. We need to let this awful period pass and then we can pick up arms and crack on again. That comes out in January. It's available to pre-order through Waterstones and Amazon, and just put Commando Mindset on Google and you'll find it.
I'll put a link in the show notes. And then where else can people connect with you, Ben?
So we also got a podcast, Commando Mindset Podcast. That's on Instagram. You can follow us on there, or you can follow my Instagram page, Ben_Williams_CM, Charlie Mike. You can find us there or findyouredgecoaching.co.uk. I'm sure if you put Commando Mindset and Ben Williams in Google, you'll pick us up. But we're pretty everywhere now, which is quite nice.
It's got to be these days because you never know where you'll pick people up. Like I say, we connected through LinkedIn, which is bad, isn't it? How you can reach people and find stories that do things for you and get you going.
It's amazing. Like, we had someone approach us from Switzerland the other day saying, we read your article in the Times. Yeah, it's just incredible. And I think just be tenacious in anything you do. Like, even writing that book has been the fucking one of the hardest things I've ever done in my life. 92 rejections on the first time round, and then 40 odd rejections on the second time round. And the person who inspired me to write was Simon Sinek. When I read his book, Leaders Eat Last, I was like, when he started talking about Afghan, I thought, I'm going to try and do a little bit of this. My editor is now Simon Sinek's editor. Brilliant. So you fight for so long and all of a sudden you may land on the doorstep you never thought you'd land on. It's just, it all comes from a relentless pursuit to achieve.
Love it.
We all have that within us.
What a note to end on. And talking of getting the word out, guys, if you're still with us at this point, please take a screenshot, pop it in your Instagram story, tag Ben, tag myself, drop us a DM, let us know how you get on, and I will speak to you all again very, very soon.